Thanks, Bruce. Thank you.
Sandy.
Very well done. Thanks a lot. There's a plaque on the front of the Methodist Church in the little town of Grafton, West Virginia, which says that the first Mother's Day observance in America was held at a Sunday service there on May 10, 1908. A member of the congregation at that time, a Miss Ann Jarvis, had lost her mother a year or so earlier, and she requested that a service be held on a springtime Sunday morning at the Grafton Methodist Church to honor both the memory of her late mother and, by extension, the lives of all mothers, those living as well as those who had passed away. It must have been a good service, as the observance of a Mother's Day became Miss Jarvis's cause and calling, to the point that 6 years later in 1914, 9 years ago today, or this Sunday, her efforts came to fruition in a congressional and presidential proclamation by Woodrow Wilson, naming the second Sunday in May as Mother's Day. Ann Jarvis, who somewhat ironically was never a mother herself, never became a mother herself, lived until 1948 and saw the day that she advocated for mothers become a part of the cultural life of our country. I'm sure she was quite proud of what she was able to do and deserved it so. But with all due respect to Miss Jarvis's sentiments and initiatives, which I extend to her as a fellow West Virginian, she was not the first person in this country to call for a Mother's Day observance. It was her efforts that happened to get official sanction thanks to her tenacity, but some 40 years before that service was held at the Grafton Methodist Church, another woman issued a call for a Mother's Day for quite different reasons than those of Miss Jarvis. They weren't really contradictory reasons, but they had a quite different emphasis. The woman was Julia Ward Howe. She and her husband, Samuel Gridley Howe, were prominent 19th century reformers living primarily in the Boston area. They were Unitarians, and Mrs. Howe was among those identified with the New England Transcendentalist movement. She was a strong abolitionist, and after seeing a contingent of Union troops prepare for battle during the Civil War, Julia Ward Howe went home and wrote the words, Battle Hymn of the Republic, for which she remains best known to this day. In the aftermath of the Civil War, however, as she became more fully aware of the extent of the carnage of that conflict, as well as the devastation brought on by some of the European wars that also raged around that same time, she became a peace activist. To the best of my knowledge, Julia Howe never disavowed, never felt the need to disavow the sentiments which she expressed in Battle Hymn of the Republic. But she also came to feel that there had to be a better way in the war to resolve conflicts between and within nations. And in time, these efforts of her gave way to her becoming the head of the American branch of the Women's International Peace Association. And so it was in the year 1870, some 5-6 years after the end of the Civil War, that Mrs. Howe issued her own Mother's Day proclamation, which, as already noted, took a different tack from that of Miss Jarvis. Her Mother's Day proclamation was a call to the women and mothers of the world to be advocates for peace and disarmament, and a call for a day for the mothers of America and the world rally together on behalf of such a cause. I'd like to read a portion of that 1870 proclamation by Julia Ward Howe. I say I'd like to read it, but I won't, as I feel it will be more appropriately read by a woman and a mother and one who has put forth her own energies in the cause of peace, and Julia Ward Howe couldn't make it today, so Joan Conacher has agreed to stand in her stead.
Proclamation of 1870 by Julia Ward Howe, edited for your convenience. Arise then, women of this day. Arise, all women who have hearts. Whether your baptism be of water or of tears. Say firmly, our husbands will not come to us reeking of carnage. Our sons shall not be taken from us to unlearn all that we have been able to teach them of charity, mercy, and patience. We, the women of one country, will not allow our sons to be trained to injure those of another. From the voice of a devastated earth, a voice goes up with our own saying, disarm, disarm. As men have often forsaken the plow and the anvil at the summons of war, let us women now leave all that may be left of home for a great and earnest day of counsel. Let them meet first as women to bewail and commemorate the dead. Let them solemnly take counsel with each other as to the means by which the great human family can live in peace. In the name of womanhood and humanity, I earnestly ask that a great Congress of women without limit of nationality may be appointed at the earliest period to promote the alliance of the different nationalities, the amicable agreement and settlement of international questions, and the great and general interests of peace.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I don't know that Mrs. Howe ever specifically got for one great day of great and earnest counsel of women. She wrote those words before women even had the right to vote in this country. But the tone of this document points to the direction her life took until her death in 1910. It is greatly to her credit, I feel, that she held up the idea that the tasks and roles of motherhood, even as they were understood and accepted in late 19th century America, did not preclude or did not have to preclude the participation of women and mothers in the public life of a society and world. We know, of course, that such a notion is accepted today from one end of our social, cultural, and political spectrum to the other. But it was a very radical concept in Mrs. Howe's day. So our honoring of mothers and our valuing the participation of women and mothers in the public arena, I think these things point to the combined legacies of Ann Jarvis and Julia Ward Howe. And we should be thankful for both of their lives and legacies this morning. And yet with our thankfulness also comes a certain sadness, I feel. That Julia Ward Howe's vision of the attainment of what she called the great and general interests of peace remains so woefully and tragically unrealized. There are times, there are weeks, when some of the more troubling and frightening realities of the larger world call to be addressed in a religious setting, whatever the designated topic for that week may be, and whether it's ever been announced ahead of time or not. For I could not read Mrs. Howe's words, written 134 years ago with that distinctly 19th century New England tone to them. Her words that said, our sons shall not be taken from us to unlearn all that we have been able to teach them of charity, mercy, and patience. I could not read those words without seeing also the horrifying images that have come back to us this week from Iraq's Abu Ghraib prison and the torture and degradation the Iraqis in prison there had suffered at the hands of their guards and captors. Our sons shall not be taken from us to unlearn all that we have been able to teach them. I happen to agree with the president when he says that what is shown in those pictures does not represent the true nature and heart of America. You're right, Mr. President. They do not. What they do represent, as I see it, however, is one of the outcomes. One of the outcomes of our being taken into a war we had no just need to wait. And with a continuing aftermath in which those sent to fight it were woefully untrained to deal and cope with. I think those shown at using the Iraqi prisoners represent our sons and daughters being taken from us to unlearn all that we have been able to teach them. In Mrs. Howe's now haunting words, by being placed in a setting where they never should have been and were completely unprepared to be. Yes, they are responsible for their individual actions, just as we all ultimately are responsible for each of our individual actions. But where is there any assumption of responsibility anywhere up the chain of command by those who were supposed to be directing the actions of those at the bottom of that chain? Yes, I do believe in personal accountability, to be sure, on the part of those who have perpetuated this abuse. But of holding those accountable who actually perpetuated the abuse and degradation of those prisoners goes no further than that. Then we'll be left with the absolving of responsibility for those who are ultimately responsible for this horribly misguided and unthinkingly arrogant enterprise on our part altogether. More than one news commentator this past week has gone to some lengths to point out that the behavior of our soldiers in this situation is not nearly as bad as what Saddam Hussein's henchmen were doing in the same prison when he was in power. This is quite true, I am sure. But that begs another question. Since when did the abuse and torture tactics encouraged by Saddam Hussein become the benchmark against which we judge the behavior of Americans in uniform? We were the ones, after all, who went into Iraq, brimming over with moral and presumably God-ordained righteousness. And now are we going to use the devil who we overthrew to mitigate our own behavior? As I know I've said on other occasions, our calling as a liberal religious community and people is not primarily always to be successful, but rather to be always faithful. Julia Ward Howe certainly did not achieve full success with respect to that Mother's Day call she issued nearly a century and a half ago. But she did remain faithful to all that she called for. It is her faithfulness that we honor today, even as we try to move our human community at least a few more millimeters in the direction of her vision. And I think Julia Howe's reference to promoting what she called an alliance of different nationalities is as timely as ever. For it will be only when we truly seek to engage with some of our current alliances of different nationalities in our worlds and step back from any pompous, peacock-strutting rhetoric about not needing permission slips in our dealings with the world, then maybe a way out of our morass will be found. Well, what you've heard so far today, in addition to the words from me and Joan, is a classic example which practically any minister can cite at one time or another of a sermon that he or she planned to write and deliver at one point in the week, not being the one that actually is delivered on a Sunday morning. And I know any of you who might still be looking at the order of service could well be thinking, well, this is all quite interesting, whether I agree with all of it or not, but what's it got to do with Families for Everyone? Well, basically nothing. Or close to nothing, to tell the truth. My sermon plan for today, we'll call it Plan A if you like, was to say a little bit about the varying origins of Mother's Day, pretty much the way it started out, and then segue into the broader issue of what we want, need, expect from, and contribute to the families of which we're a part, and in all the different ways that families manifest themselves today, including same-sex couple families. But when I got to Julia Ward Howe and then started putting her words in dialogue, as it were, with some of the events of this past week, then things went where they went. And before I knew it, I was writing a Plan B sermon before I even knew I had a Plan B. add to that that ever since the Church's May newsletter came out, just about all I've been hearing is, we want you to keep announcing your sermon themes in advance and forget what Michael Doral had to say about that particular piece of advice, anyway. So what's my response? Turn around and speak to a subject that's not even in the order of service. All right, two things. One, I've decided I'm not fond of my own newsletter experiment myself, but I did want to try it. Second, even with announced topics via the newsletter, to which I intend to return, there will be occasional Sundays. Very occasional, I can assure you, but still occasional Sundays, when I'll be led elsewhere, as I have been today. And I will speak to my Plan A topic about families for everyone on May 30th. Really? I promise. But I do need a few more minutes now to pick up on one remaining thread with this unplanned Plan B sermon for today. I opened by referring to a small West Virginia town named Graff. I'd like to give you the names of two other West Virginia towns that have been in the news in more recent days. They are Palestine and Fort Ashby. Palestine, West Virginia, was the hometown of Private Jessica Lynch. I was in Charleston, West Virginia, this past summer on a family visit, when Private Lynch had finally recovered from her very serious war wounds to the point that she could come home to Palestine to a heroine's welcome. Her mistreatment by the Iraqi forces after she'd been wounded in a shootout had left her, as we all know, nearly dead. Her rescue, with the help of some Iraqis along with the Americans, was what came to assure her survival. On her homecoming day, there was a picture of her in the Charleston, West Virginia papers, riding into her hometown of Palestine and waving from the rear seat of a convertible as she was joyously received back into the love and care of her family. Her story has already been made into a book. The movie deal is still being worked out. And to her credit and integrity, she insisted on telling the truth as to the details of her capture and rescue, and leaving off some of the embellishments that came to be added to it. Either way, she will do well in the aftermath of her wartime and battlefield experience. And whatever rewards she comes to reap, I certainly do not begrudge her any of them. Because for me, I know it was a college diploma and a graduate degree that I was fortunate enough to obtain that gave me a life beyond the small West Virginia town in which I was raised. In the economically strapped working class family where I was lovingly brought up. And now Jessica Lynch has a life before her beyond her small West Virginia town as well, if she chooses to move on. And so bless her, I say, with all the blessings that may come her way. Fort Ashby, West Virginia, is the hometown of Private Lindy England. You may have seen her picture in the paper this past week. She was not waving from the back of a convertible. She's the one holding the leash that's around the neck of a naked Iraqi prisoner who's lying on the floor in the Abu Ghraib prison. Our president has said that her actions and those of her fellow soldier guards were, quote, disgusting, and have, quote, again, made us all sick to our stomachs. I struggle with what to make of this. Part of me agrees with the president. But another part of me can only wonder how it is that one little rural West Virginia town gives us a heroine upon whom we heap all the accolades as well as all of our projections about what makes a true, great, and brave American, while another little rural West Virginia town gives us another female soldier who does things that make us sick to our stomachs and prompts our leaders to quickly hasten to point out that she is not what America is really all about. How does one young woman from one economically strapped Appalachian community become a saint and a another young woman from another economically strapped Appalachian community become a disgusting sinner. Yes, Jeff.